Okay, hello, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. It is Sunday. I am Jason Napolitano, and on the line, Mr. Chris Sheridan. What's going on?
Just a fire in the mountains behind the house.
Oh, that's all.
In the foothills, San Gabriel.
All right.
Yeah, it's a weekly fire.
I'm telling you, man. Well, we are sending out good energy to everyone in California. It's always rough this time of year with the fires, so. Hope you guys are all doing all right out there. Okay, so this week we are doing an interesting thing on the Cosmic Eye Show. We're getting into some Manuel, as if we've never done that before.
Wow!
So actually, how do you like that? We're gonna touch on something really new. We're gonna get into Manly Hall, but actually, we haven't been into the secret teachings for a while. So this is a little bit of a refresher for us. So we're going back to our secret teachings, at least for today. We're looking at chapter 42, XLII, for the Roman numeral challenged. And in the secret teachings reader's edition, the one that Torture Penguin publishes, this is page 592. It's called The Cross and the Crucifixion in Pagan and Christian Mysticism. We're going to go off of this chapter, and then we're going to kind of use it as a base for talking about the cross, the idea of crucifixion, some of the symbolism in Christianity, esoteric Christianity, and other cultures, traditions as well. And then at the end, we're going to talk a bit about some of the psychological and spiritual implications. It's going to be pretty loose, but I think we're going to really get into some great stuff that's going to be helpful. Invaluable and kind of if you're not familiar with more esoteric interpretations of Christianity, might be kind of new for you. It's a good kind of introduction to that then for you. So thank you for joining us. We appreciate all you being here each Sunday. Hope everyone is doing well out there. Thank you for supporting us, to our supporters who are financially supporting us. And please, if you can, make a small donation each month at anchor.fm/cosmiceye. And check out Chris's book, The Spirit in the Sky, or my book, If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. Both of those are available on Amazon. If you want to get a hold of us, you can get a hold of us through chrissheridan.com or cosmiceye.org. All right, so that housekeeping is out. We've finished that, and now we can jump right into some secret teachings and the wisdom of Mr. Manly Hall, who was sharing the wisdom of the ages through this book. And interestingly enough, I don't know why I like to share this, but I think it's kind of important. You know, he saw himself as a sort of a torchbearer of this ancient wisdom, sharing it, but by no means someone who is coming up with new information or coming up with anything novel. But he saw as a figure in a long line of these mystical teachers and philosophers who shared this ancient wisdom. Do you have anything to add to that? I know you know quite a bit more about Manly Hall than I do. So,
yes, this book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, was published in 1928. But he spent probably 6 years directly working on the book. It was going to be two volumes, and it became this one large book with a lot of paintings. There's so many color plates, I think 54 in total. And as a book of symbolism, he wanted to have symbols, diagrams and pictures. So it's really rich in the text, which mainly we're dealing with now because we're going off the reader's edition. But there's a lot of, you know, visual symbolism too. And he felt that, yes, in this tradition of, and it's not just keeping the lamp alight and resharing this stuff, it's also repackaging it in a way. You know, a lot of this, and this is an encyclopedia. It's the encyclopedic outline, as it's called, the official title of the book, and he sources, you know, Higgins and Blavatsky and, you know, a lot of other people from before. But I think one of his great roles is that he was able to gather all this old information and bring it together in a single book that could be shared by a 20th century Westerner, which is what needs to be done in this century and the next century, you know. that this knowledge is ancient, but maybe the ways in which the stories are told or a book is printed, of course, now we'd probably have an online version of it that you can cross-reference. But that is the role. It's both the original source information, and it's also the presentation, so that this generation, this century, can approach it.
Great, great information. Thank you for sharing that. And in addition, just like you said, I mean, you know, this he wrote this for the 20th century, but, you know, in a way, I mean, I guess we're kind of carrying forward the next iteration of it by sharing it on a podcast in the 21st century, right? And, but it's still one of these things where you, regardless of what, where the information is heard about this book, it is something you want to have a physical copy of, you know, because you can look at it online and you can see all the color plates and, you know, you can listen to videos about it and listen to us talk about it. But the fact is it's just a really, it's a beautiful book. And if you get one of the larger ones, one of the big books, if you can find one on eBay or on Amazon for a fairly decent price, which is getting harder and harder, snap it up. These are amazing books. They're beautiful. And they just, it's just not the same as looking at it online, holding it in your hands and kind of having a big imposing copy of this book. It's, there's something really quite impressive about it. And it's a very aesthetic book. It's put together very beautifully. The typefaces, the printing, the just everything about the book, the way it's laid out. And there's a lot in the way that the book is laid out that's symbolic. You know, we've talked a little bit about this, and you can go back and listen to some of our other podcasts on the secret teachings and on Manly Hall. We talk a little bit more about, I think, our very first podcast, actually, we did a rundown on the secret teachings itself. And so you can learn more about the book there. But it's one of these things where the book itself is sort of a symbolic instrument. It actually is designed and put together to open up, you know, your sort of aesthetic sense and that sort of unconscious reception to these symbols. So that's an important part of it. So I would highly recommend, if you can get it, you know, even these little reader's editions are nice too and stuff to study. And that's what we're studying from, because the big one's kind of cumbersome, but it really is a nice book to have. It's a really great piece to own for your library. So, all right, without further ado, let us jump into this. Speaking of that, you brought up symbols. I want to talk a little bit about that before we jump into this, because sometimes it can be, it's sort of I don't want to say a dangerous path, but I guess kind of a dangerous path in a way, looking at things symbolically and quote unquote mythologically and metaphorically. Oftentimes it, you know, for some people that can be kind of dangerous in terms of their faith. It seems to kind of, I don't know what to say. It like sort of kind of puts a crack in their faith or something like that, to think of something as being symbolic or metaphoric. The thing about symbolism that's so great is that it doesn't require an either or interpretation. You can literally believe in these ideas and these different stories and still at the same time extrapolate out, you know, spiritual messages and metaphorical and mythological messages and esoteric messages from them. You know, it can be somewhat of a challenge if you're stuck in that literal interpretation, but it is possible to hold both views at once. And that's one of the things that I want to encourage is, you know, being in the tension between those opposites of whether or not, you know, this is historical, literal fact, and whether or not the stories, for example, in the Bible or, you know, the stories of Jesus and different things that he's doing are, you know, more metaphorical and mythological accounts. And I'm not saying, and not, you know, which is which. I don't know. You know, so I'm not trying to dissuade anyone from a certain type of belief. We're just really, all we're trying to do is add to certain beliefs and ideas. And I think most of our listeners here are open to these interpretations, or, you know, you wouldn't be here. But at the same time, we also can't forget the historical and sort of actual lived life of a lot of the people that are in these accounts and so on that we hear. So try to stay in the middle between that tension. It'll give you more of an understanding and a deeper appreciation for this work. It's sort of a razor's edge. And that'll, you know, that's going to come into play when we talk a little bit more about the psychological interpretations and the esoteric interpretations at the end and how they apply to our lives. So just kind of keep that in mind as you're listening to some of these ideas that Chris and I are presenting today.
Well, I think what you're getting at is that for some people, it's possible that having a kind of a mushy, metaphorical, symbolic, interpretive version of these symbols somehow takes away from their strength if they are otherwise perceived as fact.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it. Excellent.
You know, it's not really a threat. And I like how you said it's adding to it. If your belief is that, you know, this is exactly true and it happened this way and this is exactly what it means and it's a very literal symbol, that's not going to be challenged by adding this other layer. I think it actually expands and makes it even more exciting.
I completely agree.
It has such broader and deeper implications.
Yeah.
But yes, there is a tendency that it's like, oh, this is challenging, or it shakes it off its truth foundation if it could also mean this and also mean that.
Yeah.
It's not an either or, it's in addition, and it's enriching. And that's, I think, what Hall was about too, is, you know, adding to the dialogue. He was very much a Christian mystic and, held these truths very dearly. And he was able to look at them symbolically and metaphorically. And I think that strengthened his faith more than it did take away from it.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think that's more of a classical mystic interpretation to begin with of any faith, whether you're a Sufi Muslim or, you know, a mystical Christian or, you know, a Kabbalistic Jew or what have you. You know, it's a sort of universal interpretation, generally speaking, of these ideas. And there's more openness for exploration in the mystical mindset, let's call it. So that's the approach that we're taking, is there's a deep reverence and love and understanding and, you know, the power and the depth and beauty in these messages. And at the same time, being open enough to say, okay, what about, let's take this to another level and look at it in this way or that way, or let's look at it as a metaphor for life or what have you, you know, and doing that in a very reverent and respectful way. So that's what we're trying to do. So let me start out here. I want to just kind of read through what Manly Hall has to say at the beginning of this, and it's going to just kind of set our course in some ways of how these interrelated ideas work together. It's a nice story. It's from the Aurea Legenda by Jacobus de Vorgain, or Vorgain. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that, but it is it's a folk tale with biblical characters in it, and it speaks about this tree of life, this cross, and its kind of path through all these biblical characters. So we'll start out with this. So basically, it starts with Seth. And Seth is the son of Adam, and Adam is at the end of his life, and he sends Seth out to find this oil of mercy which God had promised mankind. So Seth sets out on this path, and I'll just read then from Manly Hall's work, and then we'll kind of discuss it a little bit and see how it kind of fits into the whole scheme of things. So Seth, following the directions of his father, discovered the Garden of Eden without difficulty. The angel who guarded the gate permitted him to enter, and in the midst of the garden, Seth beheld a great tree, the branches of which reached up to heaven. The tree was in the form of a cross and stood on the brink of a precipice which led downward into the depths of hell. Among the roots of the tree, he saw the body of his brother Cain. Cain, of course, his brother who killed his other brother Abel, Seth's third brother, held prisoner by the entwining limbs. The angel refused to give Seth the oil of mercy, but presented him instead with three seeds from the tree of life, some say the tree of knowledge. With these, Seth returned to his father, who was so overjoyed that he did not desire to live any longer. 3 days later, he died, and the three seeds were buried in his mouth, as the angel had instructed. The seeds became a sapling with three trunks in one, which absorbed itself into the blood of Adam, so that the life of Adam was in the tree. Noah dug up this tree by the roots and took it with him into the ark. After the waters subsided, he buried the skull of Adam under Mount Calvary, and planted the tree on the summit of Mount Lebanon. Moses beheld a visionary being in the midst of this tree, the burning bush, and from it cut the magic rod, which he was able to bring water out of a stone. But because he failed to call upon the Lord the second time, he struck the rock and was not permitted to carry the sacred staff into the promised land. So he planted it in the hills of Moab. After much searching, King David discovered the tree, and his son Solomon tried to use it for a pillar in his temple, but his carpenters could not cut it so that it would fit. It was always either too long or too short. At last, disgusted, they cast it aside and used it for a bridge to connect Jerusalem with the surrounding hills. When the Queen of Sheba came to visit King Solomon, she was expected to walk across this bridge. Instead, when she beheld the tree, she refused to put her foot upon it, but after kneeling and praying, removed her sandals and forded the stream. This so impressed King Solomon that he ordered the log to be overlaid with golden plates and placed above the door of his temple. There it remained until his covetous grandson stole the gold and buried the tree so that the crime would not be discovered. From the ground where the tree was buried, there immediately bubbled forth a spring of water which became known as Bethesda. To it, the sick from all Syria came to be healed. The angel of the pool became the guardian of the tree, and it remained undisturbed for many years. Eventually, the log floated to the surface and was used as a bridge again, and this time Calvary and Jerusalem, this time between Calvary and Jerusalem, and over it Jesus passed to be crucified. There was no wood on Calvary, so the tree was cut into two parts to serve as the cross upon which the Son of Man was crucified. The cross was set up at the very spot where the skull of Adam had been buried. Later, when the cross was discovered by the Empress Helena, the wood was found to be of four different varieties contained in one tree representing the elements. And thereafter, the cross continued to heal all the sick who were permitted to touch it. So that's a very interesting tale from the Middle Ages. And you see this interesting idea of all the sort of iterations of this tree until the time it finally comes into its culmination where it's put on Golgotha, where Jesus was crucified, literally over the top of the skull where Adam was buried. And that's there's a lot of symbolism in that. To unpack that whole story would take multiple shows. So we will just talk about one aspect of it, which I find very interesting. But the idea there that Jesus then is supplanting Adam, basically, as a new creation. He's the new Adam, more or less. He's this risen human being and this resurrected and perfected human being that redeem humanity, you know, in the idea of, you know, Orthodox Christianity. You know, Jesus died for the sins that Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden for, which was eating from the tree of knowledge. So in this whole kind of cycle, you see this idea that Christ then is this new form of man, is this resurrected and perfected form of man. The point where that actually occurs, though, is over the skull of Adam himself as the old kind of representation of humanity. And Jesus, of course, representing this new form of humanity. So it's a very interesting story. I just wanted to kind of lay that. It's kind of long, but it's interesting to me. And I think it ties together all these different elements, and it does it in such an interesting and creative way that you can kind of see that this tree of life idea, this tree of life, this tree of death, this crucifixion motif, this idea of the cross itself, how all these things are woven together and form such a deep part of both traditional Christianity and esoteric Christianity, as well as a lot of other religious traditions that use the cross. And we'll talk about a bit of that as we go on. One thing I wanted to say too, in kind of conjunction with what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, in terms of symbolism, a lot of times, you know, more traditional Christians find it kind of annoying. I don't say annoying, but they tend not to like to hear about representations of things or symbolic things that take place in other religions that somewhat resemble Christianity. And, you know, I think they feel threatened by the fact that there are these ideas running throughout other religions. And I've always found that to be kind of odd, because for me, it's like, I guess the more the merrier, Like the more, you know, if I, the more I see an idea out there, the more that I see it universally accepted, the more I think that there's probably it. Whereas if just one person or one group has an idea, I tend to kind of think, well, why this unique idea amongst these people? And we're all human beings and we all have very similar, you know, ways of being and psyches and so on, right? Like, do you know what I mean by that? Do you find that, that like the more times you see a symbol repeated universally, it actually gives you sort of more faith in that symbol?
Yeah, to me, it strengthens, concentrates, and it doesn't dilute. Right? It doesn't dilute it.
Yeah.
Like, oh well, it's a little here, and it's a little there, and it's a little everywhere. That sounds like, you know, dilution. That you're reducing its power every time it gets repeated. But yeah, no, I think the other way. I think it gets confirmed.
Yeah.
And if Christianity or any other religion is to be universal, well, shouldn't it contain elements universal to all? And
exactly.
Maybe similar to other ones, if it is timeless, if it is all that powerful, why wouldn't it be in line with, you know, many different people's beliefs?
That's and I think that's the core of what an archetypal idea is it's a universal truth expressed in a sort of localized way amongst different cultures. You know, and I think when you look at it like that, then it like, okay, I can see that. Yeah, it's not exactly the same, and it has its own little local variations and cultural sort of derivations and so on. But I can see the depth of this archetypal idea in this particular thing. And so, you know, so to kind of get to the root of the cross itself, let's kind of look at some of the basic symbolism of the cross. I mean, one of the main things is, you know, there's, of course, a couple of different kinds of crosses. Well, there's actually hundreds of different kinds of crosses. I shouldn't say a couple. There's three or four basic designs that most people are familiar with. One is the sort of classic Christian cross with the high, you know, with the bar that extends longer on the bottom. And then there's an equilateral, a so-called Greek cross. Those are the crosses that you see more in Native American culture and stuff with all the same length of arms. And then there's, of course, the Ankh, or the what they call the Crux Ansata, which is the one that has the kind of little loop on the top of it. And we're kind of all familiar with that from Egyptian mythology. And then there's the Tau cross, or the Tav cross, which is like a letter T, basically. It doesn't have any crossbar on the top. So those are all kind of variations on this sort of cross design. And those are the ones that kind of play out in different cultures. But again, they all have this sort of universal archetypal idea within them. One of those being this idea of spirit and matter meeting up together in that same place. Let's call it. So there's the sort of vertical, which is the matter portion of it, the vertical part of the cross. And then there's, the horizontal part of the cross is the matter, the horizontal. And then the vertical is the spirit, or the, you know, the spirit coming into matter, basically. And so that's why, you know, the cross has an interesting sort of dual. I mean, this is just two of the many meanings. But there's, you know, the idea of the tree of life, and also an idea of a tree of death associated with this. And the idea of crucifixion, and the idea of hanging on a tree, is not something that is unique to Christianity, as we were speaking about before. And just some of the things off the top of my head, without even kind of looking at the book, I know of like Attis, Adonis, talking about Odin hung on a tree, or there was sort of, you know, there's these, Dionysus had sort of a crucifixion tearing apart and a reassembling, not necessarily a crucifixion, but similar sort of mythology. Osiris, are you in that section where all those are listed? Can you give a few more of those?
Sure. Well, Buddha and Krishna, Apollo, Prometheus, of course, was punished for giving fire to man, and he was eternally punished by having a raven pluck out his liver every night until I believe it was Hercules came to rescue him. But also on Quetzalcoatl in the Americas, and Jupiter and Pythagoras is in there somewhere. So
yeah, that's right.
You know, and I think you bring up, you know, this vertical and the horizontal that shows up. Just that alone is such a rich symbol, because you have the transcendent, this vertical that goes, you know, presumably the base of it is planted in the earth like a tree. So it's fully connected with matter, and then the vertical extension moving upwards towards the heavens, and then this horizontal component. You could also see that in the Christian gospel of the fatherhood of God, which is that transcendent, the vertical, and then the brotherhood of man, which is this horizontal reaching out to each other. And then, of course, the right angles of a square or a cross. Then you have proportion, you have geometry, and, you know, Freemasonry, truing things up. And it all goes, it really connects with the body, because really in our human structure, you know, if you stand up with your arms stretched, the vertical bones from your feet to your skull, that's the longest part in your spine, all 33 vertebrae are right there in the middle. And then what comes, if you with outstretched hands, your arms and fingers, it's the horizontal component, and with the blood vessels, they all meet, the horizontal and the vertical meet in the heart. So it's so rich with symbolism, and it's part of our DNA. It's part of our body. It's our anatomy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that
so that's how more universal can you get, if it's in your body or if it's in the stars or something that you see every day, what could be more universal than that? Unless you're some other creature or some other being that maybe has a different body, but here on Earth with human beings, if it mimics or somehow, you know, plays to the imagery and structure of the body, well, then that's everybody in every sense of the word.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. I think it, you know, it also, there's the you know, there's the four, the element of four, sort of quaternity sort of symbolism that plays into the swords here, into the cross, so that you've got the four basic elements in there: earth, air, water, and fire. Those are the four building blocks of matter in ancient wisdom and ancient philosophy. And then, of course, you got the four directions. And, you know,
it's great in native symbolism with a medicine wheel, which is basically a circle with a plus sign in the middle, oriented north, you know, for ceremony of the medicine wheel. Very sacred.
Very powerful. And it's similar to the mandala symbolism of Buddhism, where it's this kind of focusing point and so on. And this meeting of the finite and the infinite. Then you've got the four fixed signs of the zodiac on there as well. You got Taurus, Scorpio, you got Leo, and then you've got Libra. The four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know, the four letters of the divine name of God, Yod Heh, Vov Heh in Hebrew, you know, fit into this scheme. And there's a kind of an interesting thing where, and I didn't get a chance to look this up, but I want to do more research on this. So the letters INRI that are above Jesus on the cross allude to this four letter name, and actually in Christian archetype or Jungian commentary, Edinger, a famous Jungian, talks a little bit about this, and he points out how that is kind of a reinterpretation, in a sense, of sort of a new version of Yod Heh Vov Heh amongst the Christians. They're kind of intimating that INRI is this sort of thing, or it would be Yod Nun Resh Yod if it was in Hebrew, but it's generally shown in Latin. In Latin script, but Albert Pike points out, this is in From Morals and Dogma, that the first I is Yamin, which means a sea or water in Hebrew, Nur, which is fire. The second R is Ruach, which is air, and then Yabesh Yabesha, Dry Earth. So I need to double check those. I'm not too sure about that. It sounds more like Aramaic than it does Hebrew to me, but it's interesting. So
I've heard other ones too. The INRI, mm-hmm. it's Jesus of Nazareth, Rex, which is king mm-hmm. of the Jews.
Yeah, yeah.
Iapetus, Nazarene, Rex.
Yesu, Nazareth.
I for the J.
Rex.
And Jesus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, king. But in this chapter, in the secret teachings.
I think that's the traditional one, right? That's the Roman Catholic version.
Well, it's the one I've been most familiar with.
Yeah.
But here in this chapter, he says, above the head are inscribed the letters INRJ. Calls the fourth one a J, whose
yeah.
most important meaning is in nobis regnant Jesus. Within ourselves reigns Jesus, which is anobis, where we get nobility and this knowledge, mm-hmm. gnosis, like a noble person is somebody is noble, knowledgeable.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
So that this, within ourselves reigns Jesus. And that's the heart of mysticism.
Absolutely.
God
yeah.
in you.
Yeah.
Is the hope and glory. But I hadn't really seen that spelled out like this, literally, except for in this chapter. And that's the one I'm going with now. I like that. Within ourselves reigns Jesus. And
yeah, that one's good. And
can't go wrong with that.
I think that J is kind of is a little confusing. It really is because there's no J in Latin. So they use IE. So I think he's just kind of transliterating the last I as J. But it's an interesting thing because but the idea behind it is definitely that's a great way of looking at it. I want to look at the one for that he talks about in Edinger's book here real quick. Let me find this. One thing I do want to point out though that I find very interesting is Jung's. Jung's take on this. I want to just read this really quickly. It's a short little beginning of a chapter. So basically, what Edinger does is he takes Jesus' sort of mission, as it were, and breaks it down almost like the hero's journey into these different stages, and then he looks at each one of those. And so each of these is a separate sort of stage, and that's an interesting way to look at the life of Christ in terms of the imitation of Christ, the idea of being like Jesus, is applying these different archetypal experiences that Jesus has in your own life and see how they apply to your own stages of development. But so this crucifixion stage is where Jung says the reality of evil, this is the cross or the crucifixion, the reality of evil and its incompatibility with good cleave the opposites asunder and lead inexorably to the crucifixion and suspension of everything that lives, since, quote unquote, the soul is by nature Christian. This result is bound to come as infallibly as it did in the life of Jesus. We all have to be crucified with Christ, quote unquote. In other words, suspended in a moral suffering equivalent to veritable crucifixion. She's talking about the idea of the tension between the opposites, between good and evil, between right and wrong, and black and white, and all the opposites, male and female, and so on, where we find ourselves. And and part of the Jungian work is to reconcile and be able to live with these opposites in a sort of a middle point, kind of a middle way. And that cross sort of represents, if you look at it, that intersection between those two opposites and the tension that it does require in order to find some salvation or some resurrection from that. The crucifixion then symbolically can be seen as that sort of pain that we feel, living, we know that there's a spiritual immortal side of ourselves, and then we live in this body that we know is destined to die, from the very beginning. And so that's one of the great tensions that we live with as human beings. But let me talk a little bit then about, let's get back to this INRI. Another image of the reborn self appears in, I'm reading from Edinger, in the sign of the four letters, I-N-R-I, that is attached to the cross in the conventional representation. So these letters stand for Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum, Judaeorum, Jesus, King of the Jews. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. In effect, they constitute a new tetragrammaton. That's the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh I was speaking of. In the Old Testament, Yahweh's name was never vocalized, and appeared only as the four consonants, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Significantly, this is a quaternity, which is at the same time a triad, since one of the four letters is duplicated. The dilemma of three and four, and this goes beyond what we're talking about today, but it's an interesting idea, the difference between the three and the four. Four in Jungian terms is seen as a number of wholeness and completion. It adds the feminine element, and again, there's a whole psychology that revolves around this that goes a little bit beyond what we're talking about. It's something to touch on. And the other thing, that I like this a lot, he talks about how Edinger's quoting from Jean Danielou, a biblical scholar, and he said Christ is the peace between us and has made the two, Jew and Gentile, into one and broken down the barrier which used to keep them apart. This was to create one single new man in himself out of the two of them, and by restoring peace through the cross to unite them both in a single body and reconcile them with God. So he sees the cross as this sort of place of reconciliation, of breaking down barriers, of reconciling opposites and things like that. And then there's also the idea that's amongst people. So that would actually be the horizontal portion of the cross. And then the vertical would be the breaking down of the separation between the spiritual side and then the material side of man. So there's this idea that there's a sort of a wall separating the spiritual side of us from the, you know, the material existence. And so that the cross actually represents the reconciliation of the sort of above and below, as above, so below, as they say in the Hermetic world, right? So those are interesting. Those are interesting ideas as well for the cross. Let us talk a little bit about some of these ideas and how we can put them into work in our own life. So in other words, some of these psychological and spiritual attributions and so on. Do you want to start in with that? I've been going on for a while.
Yeah, definitely. And it's this God-man, you know, the spirit being. How do you get the genie in the bottle, this reconciliation and this intersection, you know, coming together, they actually become stronger. I've been doing a lot of woodworking lately and doing some window frames, and basically it's just four sticks. But when you have the joints mortised out and you assemble it together, it instantly becomes very, very strong, very rigid. When all the pieces fit together. So I see this cross, you know, especially in a wooden version of these two things fitting together. Yes, you have the horizontal and the vertical, the matter and spirit, but at the center where they intersect, it creates a new symbol. And it is at the center, which, like in the center of a medicine wheel, that's where the four directions combine and converge on the human soul. And it's from this centered place that we can move out through the world. So even just using the transcendent and immanent, or the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, psychologically, that's a great thing to meditate upon. I mean, ask yourself, you know, are we all human beings? Do we all come from the same lineage? Are we all related? Are we all brothers? Are we all not heir to the throne of the Father, to use that symbolism, if we are all God's children? So we're all equal in the eyes of God. And that means we are equally available to receive the blessings not the haves and the have-nots. You know, I think a lot of institutions have done that. So I look at that symbol, and that's what it conjures up for me. And I can look at that fatherhood of God and brotherhood of man and apply that to the different social issues that are going on, or a host of other, you know, relationships, even in my life, you know, personal relationships. And it's like, oh, all right. Yeah, we're all God's children. Okay. Yep. This person who really upset me is actually my brother, my sister. And like families, sometimes we don't all get along, but we have to love them just the same. So it actually affects how I look at my relation to other people and to spirit, just by using that one aspect of this symbol. But he goes on towards the end of this chapter, and talking about Jakob Berme, the great German shoemaker mystic from the Middle Ages. And we can launch off from this, that what, according to him, the cross symbolizes is the surrender of your self-will, or your small s self, or your ego nature, or this separated individual sense. That has to be put away. That has to be nailed to the tree, because it belongs in the material world, so that the spirit that's been embodied in the human can be released. So it's a release of something more than it is sort of the, you know, destruction of something else. So we can talk about that.
Yeah.
As a psychological, the very psychological aspect of this.
That's a great point. And I think, you know, it's interesting because in Jungian psychology, that would be the ego self axis that Edinger talks about. So you're creating this sort of connection between ego and self, where basically the self with a capital S, you sort of usurps control of the, you know, of our lives. And we talk about that quite a bit in a lot of our Emmett Fox stuff, because Emmett Fox talks a lot about, you know, letting God be in charge and so on. It's that same kind of idea. It's a shift out of the ego into a more spiritual outlook, and into being sort of more inner directed, I guess you'd call it. You know, you're receiving sort of an inner guidance and inner direction that you're following, as opposed to listening to the outside world, to the ego's, you know, needs and desires, and to your, you know, your own sort of baser instincts and things like that. You know, and not that life is, you know, all baser instincts, but just, you know, you're trying to rise above and refine yourself and move away from, you know, from more negative actions and so on, and being more harmonious with others, and, you know, acting in a more loving way, those sorts of things, you know, kind of moving away from selfishness and egotism and pride and some of these more negative things that we have, you know, not a healthy self-esteem. Obviously we need to keep that, and we need to be able to have a center of ego, which, you know, which guides us. But in the end, though, the idea is that you're allowing God to move in and be your senior partner, as we talked about the other day on our Emmett Fox show. It's the same idea. You know, this is sort of this crucifixion idea is the idea of letting go of the ego in some ways, symbolically speaking, and, you know, and rising up and ascending and transcending the limitations of our sort of human ego, as it were, and connecting to something greater. And also that idea of separation then also is at play. So it's the idea that I'm this separate individual, alone by him or herself. You know, here we are on this planet.
And yeah, let me just read that last.
Oh, please,
from the last paragraph. Absolutely. The last, I think, two sentences really sum that up. I think we're on topic with this. He said, one of the most interesting interpretations of the crucifixion allegory is that which identifies the man Jesus with the personal consciousness of the individual. It is this personal consciousness that conceives of and dwells in the sense of separateness. And before the aspiring soul can be reunited with the ever-present and all-pervading Father, this personality must be sacrificed so that the universal consciousness may be liberated. So it's a birth as much as it is a death. This tree is a symbol of life, a symbol of death. But what you're killing, if you want to just use this, is this sense of separateness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Aurobindo called the original ignorance. It's his version of the original sin, is that you think you're a separate thing. You're out there in space and it's dog eat dog, every man for himself. And you hope that somehow you're going to be redeemed at some future state, whereas you're not connected. There isn't total interconnectedness, again, with these two points of the cross connecting. So it's the feeling of separateness.
Mm-hmm.
You have to lose it. If you want to become one with God and the universe, you can't do both.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's the straight and narrow. You can't think, oh, yeah, I've got this and I'm going to do this all on my own, or I have to do it by myself, or I'm all alone in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to, you know, find my way home. It's like, no, actually you're not. That's the underlying universal message. There is a unified field theory. You know, there is this interconnectedness of all things, of all matter, of all spirit, that we're very much part of. And I think that would be so comforting for people, and problems wouldn't arise to such the level that they are if you realize we're all connected, deeply connected in a meaningful way, in a good way. And this me versus you, or the us versus them, or this versus that, we live in this very polarized, that doesn't live in the universal consciousness. You can't have that. They're actually diametrically opposed. They by definition.
Yeah.
If all is one, you can't have, well, it's this versus that. And so this universal consciousness is liberated. Interesting that by nailing it to the things you're talking about, base instincts, or, you know, emotional outbursts, all these kind of lower parts of our nature, or the feeling of separateness and aloneness.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be nailed to the tree. And in doing so, you're actually releasing, you're liberating what's already there. This is an untrapping of this materialization. But symbolically, we need to crucify those things ourselves in our own life. And one image I use for this crucifying or nailing to a cross or a tree, imagine like a cork board or something, and you have all these pins and labels attached to you, all stuck in your body. One is, I'm separate, I'm alone, I'm, you know, I have to compete to live, I have to, all these notions, must fight, it's a struggle, it's dog eat dog. If you can pull those out like a post-it note, you pull it out in the pin, then you stick that pin on the board, and that's where it lives. It doesn't live in you. You're actually releasing by removing some of these labels and these limiting, very conflicting, meaning in conflict with other people. Put those on this imaginary corkboard or cross, if you will. Pull them out from the pin and the nail that's got them stuck in you. It's the unstuckingness. And placing them, they go somewhere, but that's where they go. They belong on this wood, on this board, on this tree, on this cross. And if they're not on you, then what is on you? Well, you have the freedom and liberation to reconnect and be in tune and in touch and in communion with this universal consciousness.
Wow, great point. Great point. You know, and then of course, you know, lastly, as we'll kind of wrap this up, you know, there's this idea, and this should give, you know, give you some hope and some strength, this idea throughout all of these different living and dying and resurrecting divinities, and particularly with, you know, this with Jesus, is this idea of, you know, eternal life, that the death of the body does not signify the end, that there is this immortal part of ourselves that lives on. And that, of course, is which we didn't really touch on, but that, of course, is symbolized by the resurrection itself. You know, and these stories that, and the other stories that kind of parallel these, like I said, with Odin and with, you know, Apollo and with Adonis and Dionysus and Krishna and so on, you know, the same idea pervades these stories, this idea of eternal life, and that the death of the body does not end life. And so, you know, these stories are meant to also sort of hearten us and give us the faith to move into death as a new, really as just a new stage, as just a transition, because really what dies and what is born, if the spirit is eternal and infinite, you know, that you have to ask yourself. And so if you can get in touch with that part of yourself, which is this eternal, spiritual, how can I say, it's just infinite energy that's connected to divinity, you know, then you don't need to fear death. And you can let go of grasping onto it so tightly to where you're constantly in fear that something's going to happen, or constantly in fear that you're going to, you know, you're going to leave your family behind and they're not going to be taken care of, or that some illness or sickness is going to overcome you or something like this. When you realize that, look, you know, God is in charge, and, you know, there's a part of yourself that is eternal, and, you know, death is inevitable. Sure, we don't want to hasten it, but, you know, we're not really in charge of when that occurs. So just to be able to have that anchor, that strong anchor of that eternal idea, that gives us confidence as we move through life, that can be an important thing to look at. So do you have anything else to add to round this out?
Well, great point. You know, to conquer death, you only have to die. But this all can be done while we're living in this body, in this lifetime.
Good point, yeah.
And that's the real, you know, transmutation. It's the alchemical process that winds up with the philosopher's stone, this elixir of life. It's really the end of all great works, is to get to this philosophic death, this second birth, yeah, as it were, the first one through water and the second one through fire. But we don't have to wait until you actually.
That's a great
die.
Point. Exactly. In fact,
have that part of you die today.
To. Yeah, you want to struggle for that knowledge and for that integration. That's a good point. While you're still alive, and that's part of our life's purpose, is to find that in life, to find that philosophic death, to achieve that philosopher's stone, right? So, great point. You don't need to wait until you die. But it's heartening to know, though, that, you know, the physical, you know, ceasing of the physical body does not mean the end of existence. You know, and you know, all the great traditions, all the great religions, all the great philosophic schools of thought say the same thing. So keep that in mind. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate your input today. I think this was a great show, and I hope that you guys got something out of it. Do check out this chapter in the Secret Teachings, if you have it, on the cross and the crucifixion. I think you will enjoy it very much. And like I said, I also recommend The Christian Archetype by Edward Edinger, as well as Jung's. I didn't really get into it much, but Jung's Symbols of Transformation, Collected Works 5, has quite a bit of information in it as well on these different symbols. So, all right. Well, thank you for joining us. We're here each week on Sunday, and on Friday we have our Emmett Fox show as well. So join us for that. Thank you, Chris, for your input today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we will be back next week with a new episode. If you can, support us at anchor.fm/cosmiceye. Or you can visit us at cosmiceye.org or at chrissheridan.com. Have a great week. Goodbye and God bless.